From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at what's behind the growing acceptance of marijuana among voters in Michigan and across the country.
Ideas change. People begin to think, well, this isn't such a bad thing. Why is it any different than alcohol?
We look at the civil rights climate in Michigan.
I think it's a responsibility for us all to work and do everything we can to get people to recognize that it doesn't take any effort to be fair and treat people equally.
And those music studies today could take you to success in many fields tomorrow.
Part of becoming a professional musician is at a certain point you kind of have to learn how to be your own teacher and learn how to gain those analytical skills that you really need to kind of crack a code or solve a problem.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Three more Michigan communities recently voted to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. But one former U.S. ambassador warns there are international implications to this decision. We find out more on today's show. Then we speak to a Michigan professor who spent the past decade putting together what's being called the most thorough reference on Buddhism to ever be produced in English. But first, a pop history quiz for you. Which state was the very first to recognize the importance of civil rights, important enough to create a civil rights commission whose mission was to ensure each citizen receives equal protection without discrimination? The answer, Michigan. It was 1963 when Michigan voters approved the plan to set up the first civil rights commission in American history. 50 years later, the newest director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights is a former state trooper. And he's the first Native American to lead the Civil Rights Department. Matt Wiesau, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciate that.
Well, Governor Snyder appointed you to lead the Department of Civil Rights, and you started in your new job October 28th. Going in, I wondered, what were your thoughts about the overall civil rights environment in Michigan?
Well, I think the overall civil rights environment, I think, is probably not much different than it's been for a number of years. We still, in my opinion, are one of the most segregated states in the country. We have large pockets of different ethnic groups in this state. And I think the effort of this department should be a little more proactive, a little more educational on getting people to understand and be more inclusive across the board of everyone's culture.
Why do you think that is? Why here we were the first state in the union to recognize the need for a civil rights commission. Why do you think there's been this kind of slacking off, if you will?
You know, that's an excellent question. And if I had the answer, or previous directors had the answer, we'd probably be out of business, which wouldn't be a bad thing. I really don't have an answer for that. All I can tell you, it's been my experience, because I sat on the commission for 8 years prior to receiving this appointment, that every director has had a focus to try to be more proactive in getting people to be more inclusive of folks that move into the state and even those folks that are here. It's just going to be a job that we're going to have to continue to do for a long time, but hopefully at some point there'll be a little less work out there to do.
As a Native American, have you experienced discrimination?
No, interestingly enough, very, very little. I was born and raised in the west side of the state, southwest corner, and quite honestly, I come from a little town called Bangor, and we were, as a recognized Native American family in my school system, in my community, we were almost celebrities. It was a big deal for us as kids to grow up in the Bangor school system. We had a rather small African American contingent. And quite honestly, very proud of my community. We were really colorblind back in those days. It would have been the late 60s, early 70s. It was just a great place to grow up. So the answer to your question is no, I did not experience personally any of that.
And it actually sounds like something you'd like to see existing today in cities across Michigan.
Well, you know, it wasn't that hard to do as a kid. I'm not sure what the difficulty is now. So, yes, I would love to see that, and I'm proud to work in this department to see if we can get a little better at it.
Kind of wondering, Matt, what areas of discrimination are your personal priority?
My personal priorities, I don't think they're any different than what has been on the plate of the department for years. You know, we mentioned the highly segregated piece. I think it's a responsibility for us all to work and do everything we can to get people to recognize that it doesn't take any effort to be fair and treat people equally. I have a hard time understanding why we go to the effort of being unfair and discriminatory when it's just as easy to be just the opposite. So that'll be one of my efforts. I think one of the things that we're going to focus on here in the next year or 2 years, whatever the case may be, is expanding our education and outreach. I firmly believe that there are a lot of citizens in this state that really don't recognize, one, that we exist as a department, and two, what is our mission, which is to protect the rights of all people and make sure there's equal access to everything for everyone.
I'd like to shift over to the issue of LGBT.
Sure.
You've got the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, which is Michigan's law to prohibit discrimination, and it offers protection for religion and race and color and age and sex and on, even height and weight, but there is zero protection for LGBT people. Why is that?
That's a question I can't answer. That's a question that's only going to be able to be answered by the legislature. The commission, the Civil Rights Commission, for probably the past 30 years, has been supportive of that change in the fair treatment across the board for everyone. I don't see that changing, so we will just monitor what the legislature does. And, you know, if that law is passed, then we will go to work to do everything we can to educate everyone out there on what the law means and the fair treatment of everyone.
Is there anything you can do, or you as the State Civil Rights Commission, is there anything you can do to advance LGBT rights and working with the legislature?
I'm not sure to that question, Cynthia. I'm not sure if there's anything we can do that hasn't already been done. You know, that is something I can certainly look into. I don't know the answer to that one.
I know you've served on the commission. What do you think the public mood in Michigan is today regarding offering civil rights protection to LGBT men, women, and teens?
For the most part, I think, in my opinion, I think if you took a survey, I think the survey would say that they want the law amended and the LGBT community added as a protection. But as you know, when you read various articles and listen to people talk, some politicians are kind of, you know, hesitant to make that vote. But I think as our population gets younger, I think attitudes have changed in that regard. So I think that there's probably support for that change.
Michigan's certainly been back in the national spotlight with Schuette versus the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. You have Michigan's Attorney General at the Supreme Court last month defending the constitutionality of Proposal 2, which, of course, bans the use of affirmative action in admissions at public universities in Michigan. From your perspective, is affirmative action linked to civil rights?
You know, you could probably make a case that affirmative action is linked to civil rights. I'd rather look at it as an issue of diversity. You know, when some people look at affirmative action, you know, it's a case to, you know, right past wrongs. I don't know that if we necessarily have to do that, if we're willing to just be more diversified in what we want to do, be more inclusive. You know, if we were more diversified, you wouldn't need affirmative action because you would already be accomplishing what you need to accomplish. So that's how I would like to do that. You've got the affirmative action argument out there, but if we can educate folks and get them to be more inclusive, to get them to be more diversified, I think we can still accomplish the need to make this a one Michigan.
As I mentioned when we began our conversation, you've been in the office for just a little under a month, but let's say you and I sit down in a year. What do you think I'll see that is new or different about the commission because of your direction?
Well, what I hope you see is a better understanding of what we do. I think as I've made my travels, I visited all of the offices last week and chatted with people and what we do and the successes that we've had in our inability to discuss in a lot of cases areas where we have been successful when you look at housing discrimination and equal opportunity employment complaints that we investigate. There are, as I'm beginning to understand, there are some restrictions on exactly what we can talk about publicly in our successes. We're going to take a look at that and hopefully promote what the mission of the department is. And I think in a year's time, I think there will be a much better understanding by the citizens of this state what we do, and by virtue of that, I think we can create an atmosphere where there will be less complaints, less violations out there. That is going to be our aim and our focus for the first year.
Matt Wiesaw is the newest director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Matt.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for the call.
Well, hunting season is upon us. Michigan leads the nation in hunting license sales, and at times we have led the nation in the increase in working poor families with kids. Neil Easterbrook is vice president of the Michigan Sportsmen Against Hunger. Neil, your group works to connect hunters and processors and then charities to help feed the hungry. Tell us, how does a deer taken in, say, Kalkaska wind up on the tables of a hungry family?
Well, typically, the people, the hunters who are successful will go to our website and find a processor, one of our certified processors that's in their location. And all they have to do is simply take the deer to their location after, of course, field dressing, and just drop it off. There's no charge to the hunter. Our organization will pay the processor for the processing. And then that meat will stay in that local community, generally, to feed the people there.
So we're looking at food pantries, soup kitchens, that type of charity?
Yep.
So give me an idea. How much meat could we be talking about, and how would that translate into hot meals?
Well, last year we collected 35,000 pounds, which is a little below average, and we've been up over 50,000 pounds. And generally per pound equates to about four meals. So we're generating around a quarter of a million high-protein, low-fat meals per year.
And what kind of feedback do you get from the food banks and the food pantries? And do you ever hear from families that are helped?
The food banks love it. Some of these food banks spend about 80% of their food budget on meat because it's just something that does not get donated by people. You know, people donate canned foods and surplus and a bag of beans and things they have, but meat is not something that people usually have a surplus of that they donate. So we really fill a gap, and by freeing up some of those funds that they would have spent on meat, they can spend on other programs such as housing and rehab. So it's not just feeding people that we do. It actually expands in other areas.
Neil Easterbrook is vice president of the Michigan Sportsmen Against Hunger. You can find out more about his program at sportsmenagainsthunger.org. Still to come, failure. Our next guest wants us to embrace it. We'll find out about Failure Lab coming up next. And then more and more communities are embracing decriminalization of marijuana. But this has implications with America's international treaties. We find out more about that in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What do you think or how do you feel about failure? It was Bill Gates who declared, "It's fine to celebrate success, but it's more important to heed the lessons of failure." It's good to realize we all fail at times. It's just most of us try to cover it up, or at the very least, we do not broadcast our failures. But there's an event that has begun in Michigan and is spreading outside our state called Failure Lab. It's a program designed to get us thinking about the meaning of failure, to realize failure happens to everyone and perhaps to inspire us to take intelligent risks. Joining us now is the co-founder of Failure Lab, Austin Dean. Good to have you with us, Austin.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why did you conceive this event?
Really, the idea started a couple years ago from a TEDx event in Detroit. And as many of the talks do, they highlight on personal kind of stepping stones throughout life. And one was very heavy on the background and a failure story that one of the storytellers shared during that event. And so it got us thinking. I said, you know, this is extremely powerful stuff. Why don't we bring people together in a room, share those really intimate stories, and see where we can take it?
And it's begun to spread, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. We've had a tremendous amount of interest. What started as a single event in Grand Rapids, Michigan, has now traveled over to the east side, to Detroit here Thursday, and we're also looking at Mexico City, New Orleans, I mean, places all over the country, which is just great.
Well, you've got a Failure Lab coming up November 21st in Detroit, so give us an idea of what that night holds.
So really what we're looking to do to provide is a truly unique experience, a short, condensed, hour-and-a-half-long performance. And so we bring in six local storytellers to share their most intimate failure stories. And then we also bring in six local performers, many people who you've heard, and they really regulate that mood throughout the evening. So what we do is it's a very fluid format, a speaker, 90 seconds of silence for the audience to actually share what they learned from that story. And then we bring in a musical piece, and we do it over and over again for about an hour and a half, and then we have a nice party afterwards.
I'm speaking with Austin Dean, who's the creator of Failure Lab. And let's listen to an example of one of these failure stories. This one comes from Andy Soper, and he's talking about the very first night that he spent in Army boot camp at the mercy of drill sergeants who are kicking and beating these recruits.
And this goes on for hours. We're getting beat up. I'm not kidding you when I tell you that kids were getting thrown through things. And we're laying on the ground trying to do push-ups and getting kicked in the ribs, and you can't breathe, and you're crying and trying to hide that. And I was out of my mind terrified. So night comes, and I'm so grateful. They shut the lights off. I'm laying up on the top bunk. It's about 6 feet up in the air. And I'm laying there, and I've never been this scared in my life. And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
What are you hoping, Austin, that audiences will feel from hearing stories like Andy Soper's?
You know, Andy's story is truly unique, and it's very moving. I think the best thing that comes from these events is that whoever's in the audience is able to share something extremely intimate. They connect on a very personal level because they've experienced failures themselves. And that alone is the thing that we want to do. We want to build communities based on these types of connections and to say, you know what, we've all failed. There are many people who fail and don't get back up again. Let's support them. Let's take additional risks, and let's move forward.
And it's important to note that as people tell these stories, these very gut-wrenching personal stories, it's also humorous because I watched the whole clip and people are laughing. There was almost a feel of stand-up comedy at the beginning of Andy's story. Then it gets extremely from the heart and very serious. But it doesn't end with, and then I fixed it and everything was good.
Right. Right. That is, I think, our big differentiator. We really want these people, it's inherent that when they're up there on stage that they're here, they're still going, they're still pursuing, you know, whatever dreams and ideals they have. But they are willing to take a step back and look at themselves and say, you know, I did fail in this way. And so we really want them to share that piece. And we think that is the main aspect of stories that people really connect with. And it's going to encourage them to go out and take additional risks themselves.
And not be afraid of falling on your face, because then you realize I'm not the only one that's done that.
Exactly, exactly.
What is your favorite part of a Failure Lab evening, Austin?
Yeah, I really enjoy watching all the tweets, comments, just thoughts that the audience is having after each storyteller comes off stage. We get that 90 seconds of failure where there's a clock up on stage. It's ticking down. You can feel kind of some of the tense vibes in the air because people aren't used to kind of that silence. They're always on their phones. They're always doing something. And so to watch that process unfold, but also see all the positive thoughts that people are having from the connection that they just shared with the storyteller, I love seeing it come in.
The next Failure Lab is November 21st at the Detroit Opera House, and you can get all kinds of information from the website failure-lab.com. That's failure-lab.com. And we've been speaking with the co-creator of Failure Lab, Austin Dean. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Well, let's move now from failure to success. Success through music. A recent essay in the New York Times posed a very intriguing question. Is music the key to success? A striking list of notables from many different fields have one thing in common. They all played some sort of musical instrument. From former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, who played clarinet and saxophone, to Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, a guitar player, to Condoleezza Rice, who trained to be a concert pianist before becoming our 66th Secretary of State, all have linked their music training to their professional accomplishments. Well, we wanted to take a closer look at the impact that playing music can have on the way we learn, the way we work. And we're about to meet someone who is building her professional resume as a musician, even as she continues her graduate music studies. Her name is Siobhan Cronin. Siobhan's working on her master's degree in violin and viola performance at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. If you've seen the University of Michigan Symphony Orchestra perform recently, she is the principal violist. Or maybe you were at Rod Stewart's recent concert at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Siobhan and her violin and her short glittery black dress were on stage with Rod. Siobhan Cronin joins us in the studio. It's good to have you with us, Siobhan.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when you think of all the notables who played instrument, perhaps still play, but went on to excel in so many fields, why do you think that is?
The thing about music is that it teaches you so many different life skills that you wouldn't think you would get from playing an instrument. So much of it is just about collaboration and relationships and listening and just really learning cooperation. And those are things that are just so easily transferable into any professional field. So those are things that you get really intense training on in music. So much of it, especially chamber music or orchestral music, and even the pop music, it's just all about learning how to read people, learning how to understand people, and, you know, all these skills that really, really transfer well into other areas.
It also strikes me that you learn to problem solve and you learn to chip away at whatever it is, because no one's going to learn that instrument by looking cute or just picking it up. You have to do the work.
Right. And part of becoming a professional musician is at a certain point you kind of have to learn how to be your own teacher and, you know, learn how to gain those analytical skills that you really need to kind of crack a code or solve a problem. You know, if you're having trouble with a particular section that you're learning in a piece of music, a lot of it comes down to just how analytical can you be and can you really hone in on what the problem is. And just about any job that you look at, you know, some of the strongest performers are people that can really focus in on what are the problems and what kind of tools do I have in my toolkit to solve them. So,
yeah. Now, you started, tell me if I'm wrong, piano, violin, and viola. When you were four?
So I started on piano when I was four. And then a couple years later, when I was six, I think I was in second grade at the time, I picked up the violin.
Why?
I just saw one of my friends playing it and I said, oh, that's cool, you know, a string instrument. And when you're young, you know, a lot of what draws you to it is just seeing it and being in the physical presence of an instrument. So that's the interesting thing about music education is that a lot of the times it's really just that first exposure to the instrument itself or seeing a person holding it or playing it that will really draw a child into wanting to do it themselves.
And then you also double majored in music and economics with a minor in French.
Correct.
Talk about that.
I had always been interested in math growing up and going through Cranbrook. And a lot of what was interesting about going to that school is, you know, a lot of the curriculum is based around exploring many different things at once. So, you know, it's not enough to just be into math or into English or into a language. You also do music and you also do athletics and you also do performing arts of any kind. And so going into college, I kind of had that so deeply ingrained in my way of thinking that I want to do lots of things all the time.
Are there a lot of other folks who are on the grad level in music who are also, like you, multiple majors?
Yes, it's not quite as common, you know, to do music and another academic major. It's a little bit more common to have two academic majors within the same college. But in fact, in my studio, I had a close friend that did the exact same thing. She did an econ major and a violin performance major. So,
and of course, some of that can also keep parents happy who would like to make sure that their youngster goes on to earn a living, which is not always a sure thing in music.
Right, right. Well, music is definitely, at face value, it's a lot more of a risky proposition because especially with the way that things work out with orchestras, you know, you never really know if funding is going to come through or if there's going to be continued support. And I mean, as we've seen over the years, you know, audiences do kind of die off, unfortunately. And you know, support for classical music in the long run. It's hard to really bank on it the way that it looks right now as a musician, you know, studying. Mm-hmm. So even just looking at my classmates going through music school, the odds of getting an orchestra job, that's one of the things that they really drill into you right from the very beginning is there are going to be probably a couple hundred people competing for one spot in that orchestra. So a lot of people, their, you know, gut reaction is, you know, maybe I should get another major, have some sort of cushion just
sure.
in case.
Now, you perform with the U of M Symphony Orchestra. You've studied with classical violin masters around the world, but you're also racking up quite a list of popular music acts you've played with. Rod Stewart just recently, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Catherine McPhee, Trans-Siberian Orchestra, Audra McDonald, to name just a few. So is it easy to move from Bach to do you think I'm sexy?
I think it definitely, coming from being a classically trained musician, that idea of breaking out of your shell and just getting into the groove and enjoying yourself It's difficult, I think, and it's strange because so much of classical music is about that perfection and about, you know, drilling orchestra excerpts and drilling very small passages in a piece of music that are very technical. And it becomes so much about removing almost the emotion from yourself so that you can just be focused. Mm-hmm. And because of the increase in competitiveness and how difficult it is to get a job, we're turning into people that are training ourselves to almost be overly technical and overly analytical, to the point that if you put a classical musician on stage with Rod Stewart and say, hey, can you put on a mini dress and dance? A lot of people would say, I don't know, because you're just so used to that being the total opposite of what you're trained to do.
Well, you were telling me when we first met that you were asking them, what should I wear? And they usually, we all have, you know, we've all seen the kind of dress that's expected when someone's, say, for example, playing for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And you were told, well, less is more.
Yeah.
And was that hard?
I mean, I very much enjoy dressing up in these, you know, sequin dresses and doing my hair and makeup. And so being kind of that girly girl, it was a little bit easier for me.
But then also switching out of the very, very technically perfect to, hey, get loose and play with Rod.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of have to wear multiple hats in one day. You know, it's interesting being a musician, especially in this day and age when to make a living, you do have to switch genres. You do have to be adaptable. You do have to be comfortable doing different things. That's kind of a skill in itself. Just going from, you know, heavy serious, you know, gig to maybe one that's a little bit more loose and rock and roll. So I think I've learned to get better at it, and it's something that you learn with time and experience. So
we're speaking with Siobhan Cronin, who is now working on her master's degree in violin and viola performance at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. And we were talking about how lucky you were, and you were lucky, as you know, to be in a school, a grade school and a high school with an outstanding music program. But let's talk about the state of music education in schools around Michigan. What's there for kids whose school districts have cut back on music or, you know, been forced to eliminate it altogether?
I think it's a very difficult time just with the state of the Michigan economy and just the national economy at large, that the first thing to go is often arts programs, as most of us know all too well. And, you know, like I was saying earlier, the skills that you gain from having a music education and a music background are so, so important to, you know, a long-term career and doing well in just about anything. I mean, the things that you get out of having a music education are so applicable to so many things that it's such a shame to think that kids are being, you know, shorted out of that.
So what are your career goals, Siobhan?
I really would like to get more involved in philanthropic work with, you know, like we were talking about, mm-hmm. putting together programs to help build the stability of music education and build programs and really help people out there. Obviously, I love to perform. I would love to continue to do what I'm doing and hopefully do more of it, travel more, play more shows, just really become as versatile of an artist as I can be. I love learning new things. I've always wanted to pick up new instruments, so who knows? I guess I didn't really see myself being here now, you know, if I think of where I was a few years ago. So especially with music, things can change very quickly. So it'll be interesting to see.
And can you pursue the kind of career you want in music and do it in Michigan?
I think you can. And I think that's the biggest misconception is that, and I've seen it with so many of my peers, the first thing they want to do when they get out of school is get out and move to New York or move to Chicago, LA. And I mean, with good reason, there is a lot of work out there, but you know, there's also a lot of competition. So sometimes it kind of evens out. And you know, the other thing is, if we continue escaping the problem of arts education in Michigan and supporting kids that want to grow up in Michigan and do well in Michigan, we're never going to solve the problem. So it does take young people to be a little bit daring and kind of test the waters and really say, you know, this is my turn to make a difference here and this is my story and I can help other kids do the same thing. And it is possible. It's not easy, and especially in music, it's a 24/7 round the clock job. You know, you're never done practicing, you're never done preparing, you're never done trying to expand your network. I mean, it's just you're always working on things all the time. So you have to be 100% dedicated to it. But if you are, it's absolutely doable.
Well, good luck to you, Siobhan Cronin.
Thank you so much.
Siobhan is working on her master's in violin and viola performance at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the more intriguing results of recent elections here in Michigan centered on marijuana. As you recall, voters in Ferndale, Jackson, and Lansing all said yes to decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana, and they did it by large margins. Each passed with more than 60% of the vote. Voters in Grand Rapids, Ypsilanti, Flint, and Detroit have passed similar ballot questions in recent years. Of course, Michigan voters approved legalizing marijuana, medical marijuana, in 2008. And a recent Epic MRA poll found a majority of Michigan voters now support legalizing or decriminalizing pot in some capacity. And that's in sync with national polling on marijuana. A Pew Research Center survey earlier this year found 52% of Americans say marijuana should be legal, and that's up 11 percentage points since 2010. We wanted to talk about this, so now we turn to Melvin Levitsky. He's a professor of international policy and practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. He served as U.S. ambassador to Bulgaria and Brazil. And from 1989 to 1993, he served as Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics Matters. And then in 2003, Ambassador Levitsky was elected to a seat on the International Narcotics Control Board based in Vienna. He served on that board until 2012. Ambassador, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
When we hear discussions about relaxing marijuana laws, I have seen the terms decriminalizing and legalizing used often, and I think sometimes not correctly. To make sure we're all on the same page, the two are not synonymous, are they?
No, they're quite different. Decriminalizing generally means that although marijuana remains illegal, that is, recreational marijuana in the state of Michigan remains illegal, police will not arrest and there will not be a conviction for small amounts in terms of possession. That is individual. If someone is caught with a large amount of marijuana, which would then lead to the conclusion that they were going to peddle it or sell it, then that still becomes a crime. Question is, particularly in the places in Michigan that have decriminalized and instructed their police not to go after people that
right.
have small amounts, is what's a small amount? And the second question is that, of course, that there's a conflict with federal law here as well and with our treaty obligations. It's not as simple a question as just saying, well, we'll just not pick people up. The rules count. The regulation of medical marijuana counts. There are a lot of different aspects of this that are important in terms of public health, in terms of law enforcement, and a variety of other social and legal questions.
And before we get into all of those issues, which are so important with the federal stance and our treaty obligations, can you give us some history? When do you pinpoint the beginning of this national trend toward relaxing our attitudes towards marijuana?
Well, for a long time, there have been a variety of groups that have been in favor of legalization. You know, there's Normal. There are a couple of big hitters, like George Soros, who have sponsored these referenda. I would say, though, in terms of actually a state doing something about it, it would be the state of California in 1996, which had a referendum which passed medical marijuana. At that point, the federal government did not intervene, and then we had a variety of states. We now have 20 states plus the District of Columbia that have legalized marijuana for so-called medical purposes.
And that kicked the door open, in a sense.
Well, I think, you know, California did it. Federal government actually took them to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court ruled that federal law was supreme, but then the federal government didn't do anything about it in California. And one state after another then began to there was a kind of, a cascade of sorts. And now, as I say, we have 21 places where there is this so-called medical marijuana.
Then we have Colorado.
Yep.
Colorado voters just decided, well, let's let the state make some money off of this recreational marijuana use.
Yeah, I think that'll be exaggerated, because if the state makes a lot of money off marijuana use, the people are going to buy it illegally. If there's a price differential between the illegal marijuana and the legal marijuana, and you can only buy it in certain places and it's difficult to do, they'll still be an illegal market.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about our nation's greater tolerance towards marijuana, certainly something we saw reflected in recent votes, elections here in Michigan. I'm speaking with Melvin Levitsky, who's a professor of international policy and practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. He's a former U.S. ambassador, and among the many activities, he served and was elected to a seat on the International Narcotics Control Board, serving on that board from 2003 until 2012. As you look at this relaxing of voter and citizen attitudes towards marijuana ever since that referendum in California in 1996, what do you credit that attitude shift to? What factors?
Well, I use the administration's own drug czar, who said that he believes that people think, well, it's a medicine, can't be that bad. One state after another doing this, ideas change. People begin to think, well, this isn't such a bad thing. Why is it any different than alcohol? I think those are important factors. It's also a case where we haven't had good leadership from our presidents, beginning with President Clinton, who kind of made a joke of it. You know, I didn't inhale.
Yes.
President Bush, who never talked about it because he'd had some problems in his own background. And now President Obama, who, you know, if you read his biography, said he smoked marijuana and, you know, did a little blow, as he said, cocaine. And, in fact, when the federal government says we are not going to prosecute or go after people who are in accordance with state law, even though they're committed a criminal act under federal law, it sends out a message, I think, from the top that, well, this isn't an important thing. Go ahead and do it. You know, leadership does count, and generations changed, and the way that certain generations look at substance abuse has changed as well. There's a variety of factors. I wouldn't, you know, point to any one particular thing that has done this.
What about the more global implications of this push toward decriminalization? You referred to the fact that it certainly puts these state laws at odds with federal law.
Yeah.
What about our treaty obligations as well?
Well, there are three drug control treaties, big ones, and virtually every country in the world has signed all three of them. United States is not only a signatory, but pushed these conventions, especially the 1988 convention, which has the words use of marijuana should be considered a criminal act. It doesn't say how whether it should be punished or not, but it says states are supposed to criminalize the possession of marijuana. And marijuana is listed as a drug that has no scientific or medical use in these conventions. In international law, if you sign a convention that is non-self-executing, that just doesn't execute itself, you have to conform your law to the obligations of the treaty, which we did. We have the Controlled Substances Act. We've been in effect for about 40 years. It has marijuana in the very top category, which says no scientific or medical use, hasn't changed. So we have a treaty obligation, we have a federal law obligation, then we have the Constitution. So what is the administration say about that? So far, it hasn't really issued what I would call a definitive opinion, but basically the same position it had on medical marijuana, which was we're not going to go in and prioritize going after people who are in conformity with state law. It will internationally, it looks like the United States, which has already been declared in violation of its obligations by the board I used to be on, it looks like the United States is a kind of an international outlaw, deciding that it doesn't have to conform with its own obligations. The brave thing to do, the right thing to do, if that's the case, if we're going to legalize federally, let's say, would be to get out of that treaty. The United States won't do that. That would be such a symbol for the rest of the world. It would be further diminishment of our image all around the world. So we're in kind of a pickle right now, I would say. Government doesn't want to do this, doesn't want to say anything about states legalizing, doesn't want to go into the states as well. What does it tell the citizen about law?
And when you see voters saying with over 60% yes vote on decriminalizing, is the genie out of the bottle? Have we passed the point of no return?
Well, a pessimist would say, or maybe an optimist would say, probably yes. I would tend to think that if we had stronger leadership, I don't think we're going to get it from this administration. They're pretty much set in their ways on this. In fact, they probably agree with it. Otherwise, they would at least try to do something, take the states to Supreme Court, even on principle. But at least it could be established that what the state has done is unconstitutional, and that the federal government has chosen not to do. And I think this idea of cherry-picking federal law by deciding, you know, which ones we will abide by and which ones we won't is a very bad precedent, not just for drugs, but in general, because a future administration could decide to not abide by another federal law that might be important to a lot of people around the country. So I think this is it's bad policy, I think.
Melvin Levitsky, former U.S. ambassador, former member of the International Narcotics Control Board, and today a professor of international policy and practice at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Ambassador, it was very good to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
There is no questioning the data. Buddhism is a force to be reckoned with. Estimates of the number of practicing Buddhists around the world ranges from 350 million all the way up to 1.6 billion. Buddhism is also recognized as one of the fastest-growing religions in the world. A University of Michigan professor has spent the past 12 years putting together what has now been hailed as the most authoritative, comprehensive reference on Buddhism ever produced in English. It's the Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism, co-authored by Robert Buswell of UCLA, and my next guest, Donald Lopez. He's chair of the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures, and he's a distinguished professor of Buddhist and Tibetan Studies at the University of Michigan. Donald, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
When you set out to write this dictionary, what was it you wanted to cover, and for whom were you writing?
Well, my field of Buddhist studies goes back 140 years, and over that time, no one has really tried to produce a comprehensive dictionary on the religion in a Western language. So there have been smaller dictionaries, a dictionary of Zen, a dictionary of Chinese Buddhist terms, but there's never been an attempt to really get all of the major terms of Buddhism between two covers of a big book.
Well, it is a big book. I don't know if we have a scale here, if we could put it on the scale and weigh it. But
5.5 pounds.
Well, there we go. We know it's a staggering book. How does this dictionary, Don, compare to what has been written and produced in Asia?
Well, the Asian dictionaries tend to be just for China, just for Japan, just for Tibet. And this was an attempt to really include the entire Buddhist world. And therefore, we had to deal with 6 canonical languages.
For those folks who are listening who maybe didn't take comparative religions in school, we've all heard the term Buddhism, but maybe people don't really know the details and the origin of it. Give us kind of a primer, if you will, on Buddhism.
So the Buddha was born in India. We think that he was born probably around 480 BC, so almost 500 years before Christ. He had a small group of disciples. He taught the famous Four Noble Truths.
Which are?
They are that life is suffering, that suffering arises out of desire, that there is an end to suffering, and there's a path to the end of suffering. The end of suffering in Buddhism is called nirvana, which is, of course, a term that we all know and which has a long entry in the dictionary, as you can imagine. So he lived for 80 years, and after he died, his followers began to spread his teachings across India. They went through up into what is Pakistan, what is today Afghanistan, down into Sri Lanka, so spread throughout all of Southeast Asia, then eventually to China, Korea, Japan, Tibet. And so certainly in terms of geographical expanse, it was much larger than Christianity for 1,500 years, really until the rise of the great European empires.
In the Middle Ages.
Or even after that, right?
Yeah.
So the first missionaries start going to Asia, well, just probably in the 12th century or so. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and when we talk about Buddhism, there are many Buddhisms, correct?
Correct, right. So we tend to think of Zen. That's probably the most famous form of Buddhism in America. And that's because of some strange historical circumstances that got the beat poets back in the 50s, Ginsberg and Gary Snyder and Jack Kerouac interested in Zen. And so that sort of spread through the 60s. So Zen was a very big thing. In 1959, the Dalai Lama fled from Tibet to India. And so in the past 3 decades or so, Tibetan Buddhism has become very big. And then most recently, a form of Buddhism from Southeast Asia has become very popular, and this is where we get the mindfulness practice that is so much in the news today.
There was a big, big feature. I've got it here from the New York Times from November the 3rd, Mindfulness at Every Turn, and it really went into detail of the growing interest in mindfulness. And you've even got the Google and the Apple execs who have given us the technology to be plugged in at all times are taking courses and workshops in how to unplug and seek mindfulness. You've got the Marines are testing mind fitness training to help their soldiers relax. We also see this growing number of yoga studios across the country, certainly here in Michigan. What is it people are looking for, do you think, when they are seeking this mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness is a very simple form of meditation that comes out of Burma in the early 20th century, and it spread throughout Southeast Asia and then to the States in the 60s and 70s. And now it's really caught on much more because there have been some psychological studies that have shown the kind of lowering of blood pressure and the various sort of neurological effects of various forms of meditation. So it's very simple. You're just kind of watching your thoughts, and as a result of that, you are supposed to sort of calm down. It's a way of reducing distraction, and as we know, distraction is increasingly an issue in our lives today.
Well, in fact, this New York Times piece describes, I believe it was a Google executive who actually left his smartphone back in his hotel room while he took a walk, not plugged in. And I dare say very few of us do that anymore. We will go home to get that smartphone. What is that costing us, do you think?
Well, from the Buddhist point of view, distraction is what sort of sends our mind off in 100 directions. And it's when our mind is not under control, we start getting involved in all sorts of negative emotions that then have negative effects for both ourselves and others. And so the idea is to sort of get that mind focused on a single object, and there are many objects one could choose from love, compassion, a statue of the Buddha, one's own breath. There are many such objects of meditation, and that's really to get the mind away from its kind of, they call it the drunk monkey of the mind that runs to all objects without our control, and we're supposed to get that wild monkey sobered up.
The book is The Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism, being published December 11th and co-authored by Robert Buswell of UCLA and my guest, Donald Lopez of the University of Michigan. We'd love to hear from you. What stories are you talking about around the dinner table? What issues do you want us to tell you more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and you can always find us on the website, michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaum, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.